Mr. M. Scott Real 14. You've mentioned relationships between prisoners in other camps, Mr. Scott. In Colditz, were there close relationships, intimate relationships between some of the prisoners?
I think this was inevitable. It was something that one didn't see in the open, apart from one particular case where it was generally accepted. Should I mention her name? In particular, there were cases which were not very obvious to the average POW, where associations with other prisoners were taking place. I think this will be an inevitable result of 5 years in a prisoner. One particular case was a fellow called Teddy Barton, who had a great friendship, and I'll put it in the nicest way, with a chap in the Navy, a young sub-lieutenant. And it was generally known that they did everything together and they were slightly changed in character. They'd sort of gone down the line.
Were they accepted by the rest of the POW? There was nothing made of this at all.
No. That was left well alone. And they were a great inspiration for the theatre. They did it with Michael Goodliffe and all these people. They were in that set, if you know. Not that I can't take off all Goodliffe in that way. It's about that.
They were part of your theatre group?
Yes. More so than the average one.
When you put theatre shows on in the castle, were the Germans invited to them? Or?
Yes, I have photographs in there. The senior British officer would invite their security man or their. I don't think he invited the commandant of the castle, but they did visit. And enjoyed them quite a lot, I think.
What kind of shows were being put on?
Well, they had things. They had Shakespeare, Hamlet, some light comedy things, pantomimes, George and Margaret, numerous types of things, which occupied them tremendously. All day, they'd be hammering and sawing and making
scenery.
So that it was a bit of a blessing in its way, and of course a lot of enjoyment for people who went and had a good laugh and took all it out of themselves. I think that's about as near as I'm going to get there.
As we approached the end of the war, and the Americans, I think you said, were coming closer, you must have been getting indications that things were coming to an end.
Yes.
What form did that take, and what were the reactions of the rest of the prisoners?
Well, it's as simple as this. One day in April, the sky was black from one skyline to another, with bombers coming over from Germany, from Lower England. And they had a habit of attacking Leipzig, a big city. And if they were coming into central Germany, Leipzig was here, Berlin was there, and they used to faint sometimes. Instead of going into Leipzig, they'd drop on to Berlin and vice versa. And then at the other corner was Dresden and also Chemnitz, the Isle place. And the air raids were horrific. The area ban, I remember this clearly myself, the area ban warning sign used to go about 3 or 4 times on the average raid. They'd be going to Hanover or somewhere miles away. And on this particular day, they must have had the thing going permanently for about half an hour. And everybody was going for cover. And of course, in the daylight, it was American fortresses. And at night, the pathfinders came by with all their lights. And there, like, the place was, you read a book here and not have any lights on. Amazing. A huge exercise. That was the start of the 56-hour raid, which has so much criticism about. I think 120,000 people killed. Fireballs and, you know, like Hamburg, really. And the first sort of indication we got of anything was things like express trains going over the roof. Of course, what it was, there were strings of bombs going down on that pattern, which wasn't like that, as you would imagine. It has the speed of the plane, plus the throw and everything else. And you had some pretty near ones.
How close was this going on to the castle?
Oh, 20 miles. Maximum, possibly a bit less. But they were really warned in that area, you see. So that gave us a very good indication that things were going to go to pot. And then I could relate now to you, if you wish, the story of the takeover, what happened. These raids continued. The Americans had obviously broken right through into central Germany. And one day, at an artillery regiment parked itself on a range of hills, quite a few miles from Kerbitz. And the instructions were, we found out this later, another story, that General Hodges, who was under General Bagby, I'm not there, so sure. It was instructed that the section of front that he was attacking had to be eliminated. It was his orders. No half measure, sort of thing. And the castle, of course, came smack in the middle of this area. So the officer in charge of the guns in this particular unit gave instructions that they would fire phosphorus bombs at the castle and the village. And the village started to get peppered with high explosives. And then, as I think I've told you before, the batman of the artillery officer had been looking through his field glasses to see how they were doing and saw a flag, an Allied flag, on the roof of Kerbitz, and told his officer, and they stopped the artillery barrage within seconds, really, of the things, which is a merciful release.
And your people have put the flag up there?
Well, I must be honest here. Colonel Todd said that we should never put a British flag up. Now, why he said that, I don't know. But the French, I think, did put one. I think, I don't know, I wasn't out on the roof. I think Varda had something to do with it, I think. He wanted a British flag. At any rate, it was all mixed up. And all we saw was a line of attacking tanks coming over the hillside, right down to the bridge, which the Germans blew just on the River Mulder. I've got some information on this, which will have to be reversed a bit for you. The tanks came over and the Germans made a bad job of playing the bridge, and the Americans were over in a crack, and they were up to the castle through the three postern gates into the central courtyard, and the place went mad then. Everybody was so delighted to see them. But the interesting thing was, and I should have told you earlier on, about a fortnight before this attack arrived, there were 1,200 Frenchmen marched to the East Front, in the Russian front, to cover this, and just dumped 1,200. They had no beds, so no, it's absolutely disgusting.
And were these dumped in the castle or in the whole area?
In the castle.
And these were the people who put the flag up, presumably? The French flag?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't like to say that. I don't know, so it's not only saying I do. But anyway, they went mad, the French, because they're such volatile people. And Colonel Todd said, every British officer will remain in his room and not come out until I give the word. Truly British and very sensible. So the Yanks came in and greeted us and ignored the French. And they greeted us and said, well, you boys want to be home soon. They got some black drivers and some big trucks. The next morning early, we were popped into these motors like hell through Saxony, straight out of the camp. And over to a place called Culloden, I think it was, an airport. And they whistled up some aircraft. And all the variations on what type they were, some people said they were Lancasters, some said they were DC-7s or something. Anyway, there was enough planes to get us all in. And we flew through very bad weather, and people were very sick. Couldn't care less, of course. The trip was the worthwhile one. And the Americans were marvelous to us at that airport. They gave us food, cigarettes. It couldn't have been nicer. Did I tell you about the little boy? It was a tragic thing. One of the chaps who came into the castle at Colditz had come right across Germany, right through France and D-Day, Aramont, all that. And he was talking to his pal somewhere a few miles back, and a little boy about 8 came up and said, "Could he have some chocolate?" And while he was getting out of the pan, he shot him, the boy shot him. And he said, what did he do? He was distracted. Come all the way through the fighting and everything. So it's just a side.
This was an American soldier?
American, yeah.
And the little lad shot him, killed him?
Shot him on the spot. And he was in a heavier state about it, because it only happened a few miles back from Colditz.
Uh-huh.
And of course we had the added thing that the Russians were coming hot from the east. It was a question of who was getting away first, as we know. But it was a very eventful time.
So you flew out from this airfield in American planes.
Yeah.
Where did they take you to?
Well, there's a difference of opinion here. I understood they were taking us to Brussels. Some people said they took us to Paris, which they didn't do. And I think where we did go to was Poix, which was outside Paris. Anyway, the pilots of these planes decided that if they were going back to England, they could have a night out, so they called in, I think it was about.
Called into Brussels
to collect their gear, because they must have been stationed there somewhere. But that's as near as I can get it. I don't know whether they attacked it or not.
And did you get off at Brussels?
No, straight down. In fact, I can't even remember that. The only thing I can remember clearly was when we came into the port in England. One of the temporary ones, you know, a dozen of them down as well. We were deloused. And
was this the kind of first examination you'd had when you landed in England?
Oh, yes.
When you got out of the aircraft, how did you get to the coast to get across to England? Did you fly across to England or did you fly?
I flew right into Middlesex, into London.
I see, yes. So you flew into
straight in, yes.
And this delousing was the first examination.
First thing I did, they were very, very kind to everybody, and they gave us rations and things. They didn't give us many. I hadn't any regimental badges on or a cap or anything. How the hell I got to where I went? I was given a travel warrant, 3 months extra rations, and set off for Birmingham, where my family were at that particular moment. And so that was the end of that, except that that night we found that we'd been put in beds side by side with white sheets and with barbed wire fence all around the camp. So we were virtually back in prison. Typically British, you know. It was nice to be back. And then we
had your family been warned in advance that we were coming?
No, I had a funny thing there. I rang them up. So I knew, I don't know how I knew, it must have been a letter or something. I rang up and I said, this is Michael speaking. My father's a bit grumpy. Oh, who's that? I said, your son. Who? And he said, your son. He said, oh, heavens. Of course, then he realized the family gathered and all was well. But it was quite an experience.
The aftermath of all of this, once you got home, in what way did this very long imprisonment and all the conditions that you had to serve it, had it some long-term effect upon you? How did you relate to being back home?
Well, I couldn't going into a room with anybody in it. I was a little tricked like this. In fact, my wife will tell you that. I was very bored, you know, for no reason or other, sort of hid myself. And for a long, long time, in fact, I went into business and I was a director to three companies. And I hope it didn't show. I got past that page, you know, that point. But my wife would tell you. She knew. I was pretty rough. And I think we all were. We were all a bit queer. It came out in our wash in the end, but it took a lot of digesting.
Did you have nightmares? That kind of thing?
Yes, I think I did. I don't remember too much about them. Funnily enough, with my problems now, as you know, I've got this Parkinson's, which is a balance thing and everything else. And I get a lot of dreaming with that. But I don't dream about codits. It's funny, I dream about business.
So you must have got codits pretty well out of your system.
Well, it's odd that. I once said to my wife, I said, you know, you'd think after an experience like that, that would be the one marker that would sort of push you on course, but it's very, very different.
Living with little food, and as you say, bickering going around you because of the stress and the tension, did that affect your way of life at home for some time when you got home? Did you have some mannerisms towards eating people and accepting people?
Yes, I think I did. I'm sure I did, in fact. I was a pretty unpleasant person. Still am a bit. I think one's got to accept that. I was right off course. And I reckon anybody who's been there. I mean, I make the comparison. Suppose the chap's put in for 5 years now, a burglary or something. He knows damn well to get a bit off anyway. He knows he's coming out. And although he may be three to a cell, by God, he was through so many places. Might have been more. So. But, no, I mean, I think the damage done is very much a nervous thing. It runs pretty deep. Because when you think of every year it's at home for Christmas, then things got a bit better and got worse, and then it's a marked difference when we had Stalingrad. That was a big marker. And we also had, of course, the desert.
Was this about the time that you felt the war was going to go the Allies' way and you were
yes.
out, this stage?
Well, I think we thought it was going our way, but we never thought we'd get out. I don't think it cost, well, I'm only speaking for myself, but we couldn't figure that one out because we were 400 miles from the nearest frontier. We had foolery all around us, you know. And the thing I was annoyed about, this is this German commandant, I don't know his name, was I think a little bit, what's the word I want? He wrote, I don't know whether you've seen the book or not, he wrote a book.
Did you have a comment in
yes.
the book? Yes.
Yes. And his comments were that these were our friendly gentlemen. And I think that's a lot of you know what. And surprisingly, the number of chaps who I spoke to, the same feeling. He's trying to, you know, they're our allies now and all this sort of thing, but you can't just accept that, at least I can't. I do. In fact, I've got some information here which would be interesting to you. I haven't already given you. Right.
You came home on leave, Mr. Scott. How long was the leave that you got?
3 months.
And then you would then go into the demobilisation situation. How did that come about?
Not quite. We were given 3 months leave with double rations, which was exceptional in those days. When that time finished, I was sent to Oxford to an officer's training college, I suppose it was. And I laughed because I arrived there, expecting to have the works, and I found that all the local headmen who did this had all gone off to London for the weekend. So I was on my own. So I met up with another chap and he said, well, we might as well go up to London. So I went up and had a night out in London, or 2 nights after, and went back to Oxford, and they said, well, what was your interest? Well, I said, well, it was mining, really. I said, it's British. Well, sure, nobody knows anything about mining here. You know, it's a hellish casual. And in the end, they said, oh, well, the government might have a train. So they sent me to Hartlepool, I think, Beesham, to a holding battalion, Colonel Coley, a very nice bloke. And we did absolutely nothing, because there was nothing to do. Everybody's waiting to get demobbed. And I think I got demobbed at York. It wasn't too bad a fit, my suit or whatever it was, bowler hat or whatever. And then I think the demob didn't take very long. They got through them pretty quickly. And if I remember, it was 45, I think it was 46 when I was actually demobbed due to my, I wouldn't swear to that, I don't know, I haven't got my papers, but I think I might have them actually. But, then I had to go to, let's see, to get back into the world. Oh yes, I then went back into mining.
Were you medically examined as part of your demobilisation?
Oh yes, intensively. We had a good check. I was trying to think where we had that. I think it was at Oxford actually, before they launched us into a holding battalion. I think it was Oxford.
What was the civilian clothing given to an officer who was demobilising?
Oh, well, you got a suit, and I think one box shoes. Everything that would, if you were standing out, would be acceptable to.
You said a bowler?
A bowler hat. And, of course, a lot of laughs in there, so people went off their tailors and got things, but you know, they serve the purposes.
What was the quality, do you recall?
I don't think it was too bad. I think it was worse spent on clothes now. I wouldn't have thought it was too bad, but everybody had them. I mean, you knew straight away who was demobbed and who wasn't. But we were fortunate. I had a regular turtle. The only thing that struck in my mind about it was, we did a bit of marching up and down and attending some functions in the village, in the town at Hartlepool and something. But what was the thing that stuck in my mind? Some stuff. Oh, Oh, yes. This will give you a date, possibly. We were called, all officers are called to headquarters, addressed by Colonel Kirby. And he said, gentlemen, he said, there's going to be bread rationing. He said the army authorities are extremely worried that there might be civil disobedience. And everybody has to read the Riot Act carefully, to be able to apply it carefully, because if it comes to the push, you may have to stand in line and warn people that they can't proceed any further, you know, from a riot point of view. That was a warning, of course. It didn't actually materialise, but it was quite a warning.
This would have been after the war finished, wouldn't it?
Well, virtually, yes. In Europe, yes. Things all happened in Germany and things all wound up. But it was, it must have been 46. So that was 45 April, it would be 46. But we were at Sedgefield, that's how I remember the place, lunatics.
So you were demobilized at York, and then did you take some kind of holiday, or did you launch yourself into your civilian career?
Oh no, I went home and had to decide what I was going to do from there. Naturally, my mother and father were anxious that I got settled in, but they didn't take very much to me. In my mental state.
The people around you at home, you know, the friends and acquaintances around you, did you feel that they treated you differently in any way because you had been a prisoner of war against someone who had fought right through?
No, I don't think so. I think they were a bit sorry for the people who came in touch with me because I was obviously awkward. In fact, so much so that when I went to my mining, instead of being up at Horden, which is where I wanted to be, I was went to the Warwickshire Coal Company, Sandbatch, Sandmore Park, with the thick coal seams there. And of course, a wonderful experience, but I managed to get that through my father, who was senior division inspector of mines still. And, you know, he said, top job. And so I got into the mines there. And then a funny thing happened. Twist of fate that has in there. I was walking down the railway underground with an old boy, who was a master wasteman. And I was sitting down. And he said, I don't know what the hell you're doing down here. He said, a chap with your experience and education, he said, you should be out. Pleasing yourself. He said, you don't get anywhere here. So I came out of the pit and I told the manager, who was a friend of mine actually, I'm packing it in. I was making good wage, you know, just workman's wage, but it was good. And we were having all sorts of chits and things, some business people coming to tell us how to tie electricians and not and all the rest of it, you know.
What was the job you were doing down this mine?
I was doing a foreman's job, which was in charge of explosives, drilling holes, and drilling coal and stone, which was a responsible job. But, I was in D's. I wasn't at home. That's where the break came. I don't think my father managed it.
And you left that job?
I left that job. And once again, the gods were good to me, and I got the offer of attending a meeting at Hugh Woods in the trading estate, and Hugh Wood himself, I was interviewed by him, and another chap in the Navy, and another fellow in the Army, and he took me on. And I never looked back for 18 years after that, and rose to the director of the company. And then they're all taken over, and then that goes into a long saga of business.